This sermon was recorded at Christ Church Overland Park, a congregation that seeks to be a people fully alive in God's kingdom.
So today we're continuing in our Easter series, Resurrection Stories, where we're looking at various encounters people had with the risen Jesus. And today we're going to look at this story that's probably one of the most famous and treasured stories in the New Testament, the road to Emmaus, these two disciples who are walking along and the Lord comes and begins speaking with them. There's a famous painting in London that the National Gallery called The Supper at Emmaus, painted by Caravaggio. And aside from the fact that they're white Europeans, I like the scene here. I really think there's three things that Caravaggio is trying to do here. First, I think he's trying to draw our eyes to Jesus and to search for what did they see? Like, what was the trigger for them? A lot of people theorize, and this theory was around in Caravaggio's day in 1601, that they saw the nail print, you know, nail scarred hands, and that was the clue, like when he broke the bread. But you notice that he has hidden Jesus' right hand with his fingers folded back, so you cannot see whether or not that scar is there. I think he also wants us to feel that kind of the shock, the instability of the moment. You see the one disciple, he's like getting ready to come up out of the chair. The other disciple, his arms are flung open in surprise. And you even see that bowl of fruit. Like, see, it's about ready to fall off the table. I think finally, though, what he's really trying to do here is to draw us into this story. It's a life-size painting, so like when you're standing in front of it, it's just this huge painting, and you see that there's a place has been left for you at the table. And you notice Jesus' hand is reaching out, the hand of the disciple, kind of drawing and pulling you in to the story. And that's really what we want to do this morning. We want to look at this story, not just to learn facts, but to be drawn into it and to see what is taught to us, you know, what we can learn here about the risen Jesus. And I really want to focus kind of on two things, two headings. Jesus is hidden, and Jesus is revealed. That's essentially this story. Jesus is hidden, but then he is revealed. And so we'll start with Jesus is hidden. Luke 24, 15 and 16, as they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. Kept from recognizing him. It's very interesting. Jesus is right there with them, but they didn't recognize him. Now, we know in some way that after the resurrection, Jesus was different. We don't know how. We're only left to kind of theorize. But Mary didn't recognize him. The apostles didn't immediately recognize him at the Sea of Galilee. There's something different about him. But again, it's never explained. We don't know what it is. But here, Luke tells us they were kept from recognizing him. In other words, there's some sort of spiritual blindness that is plaguing Cleopas and his companion. Why couldn't they recognize Jesus? I think that's an important question for us to kind of ponder, think about. Because the reality is, one of the things I think we learn from this story is that Jesus might actually be right there. You just don't know it. You're not aware. You don't recognize him. We may actually be plagued by the same kind of spiritual blindness as those two disciples. And so I want to put out two reasons that I think they may have been difficult for them to recognize Jesus. First, I think the risen Jesus is hidden from them because he was so absolutely ordinary. He was just absolutely ordinary. You know, one thing that we ought to really ponder about this story and really all the different resurrection stories is this. If you were going to make up a story about a hero, so you're this little group of people in the first century in Palestine, we're going to make up a story about our hero, a Messiah. And he's going to be killed, and then he's going to be raised back to life. And not just the same kind of life that he had before, but now a whole new dimension of life. Would you make that hero so ordinary that he literally could be walking down a road with other people on it and no one would even take notice of him? I don't think so. You know, the Gospel of Peter. You say, wait a minute, there's no Gospel of Peter. Well, not in our Bible, but there is a document referred to as the Gospel of Peter. It was written about 150 AD, so a good 60 plus years after our last Gospel was written, which is the Gospel of John, written around between 80 and 90 AD. Now, this writing was rejected by the early church fathers, not put in the Bible because they said it was not apostolic, it was not authentic. And there are all kinds of reasons why it was held to be that way. But you think about, so what would motivate a person in 150 AD to write a story but essentially change real certain elements of that story? What did he want to change about the story of Jesus? Well, among other things, the author did not like how ordinary Jesus was after the resurrection. So he made him not so ordinary. In the Gospel of Peter, these two angels, they descend from heaven and there's this bright light and a big crowd is drawn to the tomb. They blow open the tomb. They go in and they bring out Jesus. And it's described this way. It says, the heads of the two angels reached up to heaven, and the head of Jesus reaches beyond the heavens. You say, well, what the heck? What does that mean? Well, what it essentially means is they aren't ordinary, okay? After the resurrection, Jesus is described as this almost mythical superhero kind of character. Someone you would definitely notice if he was walking down the road. But the risen Lord, the real risen Lord, comes to them on the road, just another guy walking along, and they think he's kind of clueless. Like, well, what's your deal? How can you possibly not know what is going on? You must be from not around here. He's so ordinary that it challenges them. And I think it challenges us. I don't think that's what we would imagine about the resurrected Jesus. I think a lot of people today miss Jesus because they don't really perceive that he is involved in their everyday, ordinary lives. They're only looking for him in the extraordinary. You know, the voice from heaven, something really dramatic. And I want to be clear, Jesus does sometimes work in really remarkable, powerful ways. And when he does, it's awesome. We should really be thankful for those times. But Jesus also works and is present in the everyday, ordinary circumstances of our lives. We have to learn to see him in those situations as well, because that's where we live most of the time. I don't know about you, but most of my life is very, very ordinary. When I'm preparing couples for marriage, I always tell them this. I say, look, some of the days, a few of the days of your marriage are going to be incredible. They're going to be like the best days of your life. And a few of your days of your marriage are going to be really dark days, hard days, some of the worst days of your life. The vast majority of the days of your marriage are going to be absolutely ordinary. You're not going to remember anything about them other than you just did life together. And my challenge to them is always, you've got to learn to appreciate those days, because that's where most of your marriage is. And the same is true for a relationship with Jesus. Most of our days are going to be absolutely ordinary, and so it's important we learn to see him there. They didn't recognize him because he was extraordinarily ordinary, which they didn't expect. But they also didn't recognize him, and I think this is even more significant. They didn't recognize him because they did not understand how deeply they needed to be redeemed. They didn't understand how deeply they needed to be redeemed. Verse 20 and 21, so they're explaining to the clueless guy on the road, the chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. They crucified him, but we had hoped. It's like, wait a minute, guys. The crucifixion is the way that Jesus redeems Israel. The crucifixion is the way that Jesus redeems us. You know the word redeem, it means to buy back and release from slavery. So that's what they were talking about when they talk about this word redemption. Cleopas thought that the Messiah would come and to set them free from the slavery that they were experiencing under Roman occupation. In other words, Cleopas thought that he needed a Messiah who would set the nation free from its negative external circumstances that were oppressive to them. And if that could happen in his world, everything would be fine. But the reality is that Jesus came to release Cleopas and all of us from a much, much deeper form of bondage. We just had a baptism down at the 9 o'clock service, and the language in the baptism talks about what this deeper bondage is. It's called slavery to sin. The Bible teaches that we are all, in our hearts, slaves to that part of us that does not want to live in obedience to God. We want to be our own masters. And as a consequence of wanting to be our own masters, we become slaves. But Cleopas, he didn't see that in himself. And neither did any of the rest of them. So he mistakenly was looking for a Messiah who would come and fix his circumstances, who would set them free from the bad guys. And in his mind, then, that means the cross was the end of it. Well, the cross ended any hopes of that. You know, many of us, I think today, many, many people can't see Jesus for the same reason. It's because what they want is a Messiah who will fix their circumstances, not a Messiah who wants to do a deep work in their hearts. That's a big difference. You know, our bishop, Todd Hunter, just a great godly man, and he always talks about the times that he would spend with his mentor, Dallas Willard. And Dallas Willard was a great Christian man who's now with the Lord. But Todd would call Dallas and say, hey, you know, he'd kind of go through the litany of all the problems that he was having in ministry. And Dallas would always respond this way. He would say, Todd, God's projects are not your projects. You are God's project. You want God to fix all this stuff for you, and He's actually more interested in fixing you, working on you. You know, we all want a Messiah, as long as He's going to stay focused on fixing all the things in our lives that we don't like. And I think because of that, many people fail to recognize the real Jesus, because that's not actually His first agenda. You know, we fail to understand that the true Messiah is first and foremost focused on redeeming and transforming our hearts, because He knows He can't deal effectively with all the problems out there until He deals with what's wrong in here. And so I just want to ask you plainly this morning, do you see the slavery of your own heart? Do you see your deep need of redemption? Because only if you see your deep need for redemption will it make sense that the Messiah had to die on a cross. Do you see your deep need for redemption, or do you simply want a God who will give you what you want? There's a big difference between those two. In the latter, let me ask you this. Who is really God? Who is really being served? I've heard that story so many times. Oh, I don't believe in God anymore. Why not? Well, because He basically didn't do this, this, or this. Oh, so that's his deal. So we believe there's a God who created all of this, and yet His purpose is to just do what we want? Come on. But I hear it all the time. Jesus is hidden because He was absolutely ordinary, but also because They didn't understand how deeply they needed to be redeemed, and neither do we a lot of the time. We don't understand. They didn't understand because they didn't conceive that the only way that Jesus could bring about the redemption that they really needed was to die on a cross. So that's the first part of the story. Jesus is hidden. He's hidden from us. But the second part is the reverse. Obviously, He is revealed. And I think that one reason that Luke chose this story, because, you know, there are other instances where people saw the risen Jesus. Why did He put this story in? Well, I think part of it is because the way that Jesus is revealed in this story can happen today. It can happen today. Notice Jesus in the story never goes, "Hey, guys, hey, it's me." No, there's some very specific ways that Jesus wants to reveal Himself in this story. What does He do? He does two things. First, He opened the Scriptures to them. He opened the scriptures to them. Now, what's that mean? Because if you know anything about first century Jewish men, it's that they knew the scriptures. They knew the Old Testament. They'd been reading the Old Testament from the time they were little kids. They had vast portions of it memorized. They had read it their entire lives. So what did Jesus do that was different? Well, he tells us, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. So he basically walked them through the Old Testament and showed how these scriptures were all talking about the Messiah. And what the Messiah, who he was going to be and what he had to do. You see, they had read it all before, but they had never read it with the hermeneutic, the interpretive key that Jesus gave them. That all the scriptures are really about him. All of the Old Testament really points to him. You know, there really are two ways to read the Bible. One is kind of a moralistic Aesop's Fables way, or you can read it in a Christ-centered, a gospel way, if you will. For example, let's think about the story of David and Goliath. You know, you can read that story and go, well, the conclusion here is that we should all be like David. We should all try to be like David. We shouldn't be afraid of our enemies, no matter who they are, because the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And that sounds really inspirational. You know, just go be like David. Great. That'll work for about 5 minutes. Or we can read the story of David and read that, you know, he's the youngest, the weakest son. The youngest and the weakest son is the one who goes and slays the greatest giant, the greatest enemy. And he slays him not with weapons of war, but with a little slingshot. And you say, read that, and you go, ah, that story points us to Jesus, who faces the greatest giants of all, evil and death, and defeats them in an even weaker way than David. He defeats them by dying on a cross. The story of David points us to the reality that God's salvation comes to us not through strength, but through the weakness of Christ. And of course, David is in that story with Goliath, he's a great example of faith and courage. I'm not diminishing that. He's a great example of faith and courage. But he's also a great example of being an adulterer and a murderer. And I don't think we want to emulate that in our lives. So, you know, the point is, Jesus is saying, look, it's all pointing to me. If you read the Bible in a moralistic way, you end up with just a very long list of things that you're supposed to do and things you're not supposed to do. And of course, the Bible does have commands in it about things we're supposed to do and not supposed to do. But the primary purpose of the Bible, and Jesus even says this explicitly in John chapter 5, the primary point of the Bible is to discover him, is to meet him, to have him revealed to us. So when we read the Bible, we need to be looking for Jesus and to see how it all points to him and what he has done for us. It makes all the difference in the world in how you read the Bible and what you take away from what you read. So Jesus is revealed to Cleopas and his companion because Jesus opened the scriptures to them so that they could see, ah, the Messiah had to suffer. The cross makes sense now. The Messiah had to suffer, and then he would enter into his glory. And then, of course, the second revealing act of Jesus comes in the breaking of the bread. He took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. That is almost word for word exactly what Luke wrote two chapters earlier describing the Last Supper. And it's at that moment, in the breaking of the bread, that their eyes are opened and they see Jesus. You know, did they see his nail-scarred hands? I don't think so. Because the emphasis in the story is not on their nail-scarred hands, not even mentioned. The emphasis on the story is on the bread, broken and given to them. You think, well, wait a minute, but were these two disciples at the Last Supper? I don't think so. We're not told they were, for sure. So how would they get this, you know? I don't know. But somehow, in the breaking of the bread, they saw Jesus. And I think this story, the supper at Emmaus, you know, it's not primarily about looking back to the Last Supper. I think it's a story that actually points us forward. Not just about the Last Supper that Jesus had with his closest disciples, but it points us forward to the way that Jesus would share a meal with his disciples for the rest of history. That when we come together around two things. The Word, he opened the Scriptures to them, and the table, where we break bread and pour wine. And we believe that when we come together, that somehow Jesus meets us here. He meets us here at this table and nourishes us in the broken bread, in the poured wine, satisfying us and sustaining us with his presence, feeding not our stomachs, but our hearts. And so in this way, Jesus gives us the gift of his presence when we come to the table. James Montgomery, a hymn writer, puts it this way: be known to us in breaking bread, but do not then depart. Savior, abide with us and spread your table in our heart. God gives us his sustaining presence, and he nourishes our hearts when we come and receive from the risen Lord. And that's what we do every time we come together as his people.